Are you looking for a Christ-centered, cross-focused church? Check out the new Find a Church page at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Find a Church. Are you tired of worship that's more about self-help than the Savior, the Christian rather than the Christ, and the Christ in you instead of Christ for you? It's not about you, it's about Jesus for you. Find a church near you, issuesetc.org. Click Find a Church.
The Holy Quran tells us, O mankind, we have created you, and we have made you into nations, so that you may know one another. The Talmud tells us, the whole of the Torah is for the purpose of promoting peace. The Holy Bible tells us, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. The people of the world can live together in peace. We know that is God's vision. Now that must be our work here on earth. Thank you. And may God's peace be upon you. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. That's how President Barack Obama in Cairo late last year ended a speech to the Muslim world. It's a speech directed at Muslims. He's calling for peace among those who hold different religious views. And he says it's God's vision. Now, for those who follow religion in journalism, they said that speech and the call for religious tolerance and peace among Christians and Jews and Muslims and all the world's religions deserve top place in all of the religion stories. There were a lot of religion stories during 2009. We're going to talk about as many as we can with Terry Mattingly. We're coming to you live this Monday, January the 4th. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest. He's founder of GetReligion.org, and he writes a weekly On Religion column for the Scripps Howard News Service. He joins us for the rest of this program today. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, Merry 11th Day of Christmas.
Yes, to you as well. The Religion News Writers Association poll says that, and I was surprised by this actually, that the top religion story for 2009 goes to the Cairo speech for President Barack Obama. Do you agree with that decision, making that the top religion story for 2009?
Well, not only do I not agree with it, I've got a sneaking suspicion, just when I've looked at some of the other lists that are everywhere that are running, I think all kinds of people this year didn't agree with that decision. But I think that this was a year when all religion was local to some degree. I mean, that a lot of folks are picking some stories that affects their part of the country more than others. I mean, whether that was a religion angle of the economy. I mean, like, for example, if you're in Louisville, Kentucky, you probably think the economy and its effect on the staff of the Presbyterian Church USA might be the story of the year. I mean, because that is, you know, the economy is huge. It's a big story, and that's sitting in your backyard. I've read some people that thought the first beginnings of financial struggles in the Southern Baptist Convention. And sometimes, I mean, some people thought that was the story of the year. I personally thought that health care, the religion story elements of health care, was the story of the year, especially since when you get right down to it, in many ways, that's what the whole Obama at Notre Dame story was all about, was Obama and progressive Catholics who run Notre Dame kind of colliding with traditional Catholic teachings on abortion and embryonic stem cells and end-of-life planning and a host of other issues like that. And those are the very same issues that lurk, that loom, obviously, over the healthcare battles. I mean, and with the Stupak Amendment, you know, in the House. I can't tell you the name of the reporter, but I heard from one national-level reporter, and I wrote about this at GetReligion.org, who called me up shortly before he wrote a national story on the religion and the healthcare battles. And he couldn't believe that nobody was covering all the stuff that was going on behind the scenes related to the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference and Catholic groups on healthcare. And he said, you know, this, everybody thinks this healthcare thing is just about money, you know, that it's just rolling towards some sort of inevitable conclusion. He says, you know, nobody seems to realize that this thing's abortion is going to hit, that the public funding of abortion is going to end up being the issue or one of the two or three key issues on which health care ends up being debated. And, of course, he was absolutely right. And I would like to point out, so was Get Religion. We had been saying that for almost a year. So I think health care and religion was the story of the year. I think some religion writers pointed toward the Cairo speech. The way I wrote it up in my column for Scripps Howard was I think they thought Cairo was the story of the year in the same way that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee thought Obama should receive the Peace Prize, not so much because the speech was that important, but because it represented some new great symbolic epiphany that Dick Cheney and George Bush were no longer in charge.
Okay, let's talk about that Notre Dame speech. And, of course, we can't do without turning to the subject that you just talked about, and that is health care reform. You said that the Notre Dame speech and the president's making this commencement speech middle of the year at this famous Catholic university really does have to do with health care and selling health care to Catholics kind of over the heads of the bishops. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, I mean, I'm not so sure he was standing up there saying this is a speech on health care. I think to some degree he was standing up there and saying the Catholic Church is complex and nuanced and we must learn to get along, etc. When you look at the vice president, when you look at the Speaker of the House, when you look at Sotomayor going on the U.S. Supreme Court, when you look at the number of liberal to progressive to secular Catholics who play very huge roles in the Obama administration, to some degree, the first year of the Obama administration, one of the big undercurrents through it all was Obama saying, this is what I think it means to be a Catholic. And some, not all, some U.S. Catholic bishops saying, wait a minute. I mean, even something like the Ted Kennedy funeral dispute fits into that overarching picture. What does it mean to be a Roman Catholic in America in terms of your ability to stand up in public places and say, I think the Roman Catholic Church is wrong, and I'm going to vote this way? Notre Dame was the symbolic pinnacle of that argument, and that same argument extends over into healthcare.
Okay, briefly on that, how successful do you think the president has been in, and I think it's a conscious effort. I don't think it's cynical to say that this is a conscious. How successful has he been in winning over Catholics?
It's not cynical at all politically. You cannot run for national office in America without thinking about the center moderate Catholic vote. I mean, that is the swing vote in American politics. A friend of mine who works at the Pew Forum had a witty quote. I mean, this is the often quoted scholar John Green of Ohio. John Creed said, "And sometimes I am tempted to think that all of American politics has boiled down to the votes of Catholics in the state of Ohio who go to Mass once a month instead of once a week." In other words, the difference between the marginal Catholic and the active Catholic, somewhere in between there is the swing 10 to 20% of the American population of Catholics that end up deciding these pivotal Midwestern swing states, which decide our national offices. Isn't that a witty statement?
High on the list of the Religion News Writers Association poll for top stories in 2009, religion stories for 2009, was not so much the shooting at Fort Hood, but the issues raised again about Islam there. What do you think?
Well, we still don't know much about that story. I voted that story pretty much where everybody else did. When I rewrote the RNA's actual list of the top stories, I rewrote that item to kind of fit what I thought of it, and I rewrote it to say the role of radical forms of Islam in terrorism hit the news again due to the disturbing history of statements and actions of Major Nidal Hassan. In other words, the issue here is what did he say and what did he do before that day? Because what American public officials are trying to figure out is how you find the difference between pietism and fanaticism. And to what degree do traditional forms of Islam, some of them, hint at this fanaticism? I'm trying to remember, it was a Muslim journalist soon after 9/11 who wrote what I thought was a very courageous set of statements. I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal, who said, I mean, America has to come to grips with two things. And the two statements are this. Statement number one is the overwhelming majority of the Muslims in the world are not terrorists. America needs to come to grips with that. The second statement that America needs to come to grips with is the overwhelming majority of terrorists in the world are Muslims. And those two statements seem to contradict each other, but they really don't. Because terrorism is a tiny, tiny, tiny subset of the world of religion. And the degree to which America has to find a way to be able to work with Muslims of goodwill and Muslims who want to live in a free Western society versus Muslims who don't, you know, that small percentage of those who don't, how do you find the difference? I mean, this guy that got on the plane the other day flying into Detroit, you know, after his own father had turned him in to the British government as a threat, this was a successful, rich, well-educated young man. I mean, he did not fit what we've been told is the profile of someone who would hear the siren call of radical forms of Islam. How does the press cover this debate inside Islam over what is true Islam and what isn't? That's what I think the Nidal Hassan story was all about. The press doesn't know how to handle that yet, and neither do our government officials.
Well, when we come back from this break, we'll continue to walk through some of the major stories in religion from 2009 with Terry Mattingly, director of Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the weekly column for Scripps Howard News Service on religion. He's founder of GetReligion.org, and he's author of the book Pop Goes Religion. We'll talk about the shooting of George Tiller, the abortionist, in church as one of the top religion stories in 2009 with Terry Mattingly after this.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
Hi, this is Ville calling from Finland. I believe the day will come when you cannot enter the office as a pastor in the ELCA unless you subscribe to the ordination of gays and lesbians. And why do I believe that? Because Americans are sinners like we Finns are.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Would you like for us to post information about your congregation on the Find a Church page of our website? We'll add your church when it becomes part of the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your church's mission or advertising budget. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 at issuesetc.org. Click support and publicize your congregation to the world.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A unified call to uphold life.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The Manhattan Declaration, a new document signed by over 150 pro-family leaders, reads in part, "Although public sentiment has moved in a pro-life direction, we note with sadness that pro-abortion ideology prevails today in our government. Majorities in both houses of Congress hold pro-abortion views. The president says that he wants to reduce the need for abortion, a commendable goal. But he has also pledged to make abortion more easily and widely available by eliminating laws prohibiting government funding, requiring waiting periods for women seeking abortions, and parental notification for abortions performed on minors."
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday, January the 4th. We're coming to you live. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about the top religion stories of 2009. Terry, moving on to another shooting, that is of George Tiller, the famous abortionist in Kansas. He was shot while he attended church on a Sunday morning. And what I found interesting is the media's coverage of the pro-life reaction. I thought the pro-life community, by and large, almost a majority of it, roundly and quickly condemned the shooting of this abortionist. How do you think the media's coverage went?
Well, they wanted – I didn't see many stories that called him like that called the killer some sort of typical pro-lifer or anything. What I didn't seem – what I didn't read was coverage that took the fact that some people become violent, ironically, when they are driven out of the pro-life movement because they reject the ethos of the pro-life movement, which actually is not very radical in terms of its activity. Demonstrations and rosaries and counseling services, these are not radical actions in the context of American history. And there are people who want to do radical things. Giving a woman a coupon for a free sonogram is not a violent act, right? But so sometimes when people become too radical for the pro-life movement and they get driven out of the pro-life movement, that is when you end up with someone who's quite, who might turn violent. The press, once again, doesn't know how to draw any lines over on that side. I wish they had done more, and I wrote a column about this, of course. I wish they had done more to actually cover the degree to which the mainstream pro-life movement has not only rejected violence, but has actually rejected any hint of the theology that would even justify this in any way. And there have been articulate arguments within the last 10 to 20 years among pro-lifers on why the theology of violence is all wrong. You know, that you do not defend the sanctity of life with violence. I thought the press had a chance to go deeper there, but I didn't see much coverage of the Tiller killing that I thought was terrible. I mean that made it sound like this guy was totally a normal pro-lifer or something. Did you?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think it was as bad as it could have been.
Out in California, when they were talking about Proposition 8, I may not have been watching as closely as I could have, but I thought there was insufficient coverage of the backlash against Mormons in particular on that debate. What did you think?
There was some good coverage, but it tended to primarily be very regional. It's the sort of thing that didn't get to the level of the national wire services, let alone the national newscasts. The action that I thought was most interesting from a perspective of free speech and civil liberties, I mean, this is the sort of thing that some court is going to have to decide. That whole issue of gay rights activists taking the addresses of people who signed petitions in favor of Prop 8 or who donated money to Prop 8, putting those people's names and addresses into MapQuest and producing websites showing you how to get to the homes of people who backed Prop 8 to let them know what you thought of their actions. To what degree is that legitimate political speech, or to what degree is that threatening activity? I am pretty much an absolutist when it comes to First Amendment rights, but that one is disturbing. I mean, put it the other way around. What if you had some sort of major effort, let's say in the state of Texas, gay rights activists wanted to try to have some sort of amendment effort or some sort of legislative effort in support of their cause. And let's say that very, very, very conservative Christians, radicals of some sort, decided, okay, let's create a website where we put into MapQuest how to get to the front doors of every man and woman in the state of Texas who donated money to this gay rights cause or signed the petitions to support it. Would that be seen as a threatening act? I think it would. That's scary stuff. Yet at the same time, do you see what I mean? Some court's going to have to decide if that's legitimate political speech moved into the Internet age. But see, that information is public knowledge, right? It's the feeding of that public knowledge into MapQuest and suddenly saying, hey, why don't you go tell these people what you think? That's where it's just, it takes it to a whole other level, doesn't it? But see, the minute you say that you have private records on political contributions and political advocacy and petitions, especially in a state like California, where petitions and propositions are such a major part of their government, do we really want to say that those activities are completely secret? Do you see the tension? This one's going to go to court.
Do you think that these protests by gay rights activists, not only these but elsewhere, are going to backfire on their cause for gay marriage?
No, I don't. Primarily because how many stories did you read? How many reports on ABC, CBS, NBC did you see about this MapQuest thing? You didn't see any, did you? What's the backlash if it never makes it onto Leno, Letterman, Comedy Central, Saturday Night Live? Now, you give me a Saturday Night Live sketch that takes the Texas scenario I just unfolded and flips the thing upside down and has, you know, some Christian group showing you how to get to the front door of your local gay communities, you know, to knock on the door and tell them what you think. You put that on Saturday Night Live, and all of a sudden everybody would be talking about that. But is that going to happen? No, I don't think so.
Two of the stories that made it, and I'm glad they did, one, the Episcopal Church USA, thumbing its nose at worldwide Anglicanism on the issue of gay bishops, gay marriage, and then following apparently in their footsteps, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the largest Lutheran church body in the U.S., voting to essentially do the same thing, although they said they really didn't change their policy, they just acknowledged things that were already happening in their midst. How do these two stories go together if they do?
Well, first of all, those two churches already have shared communion. You could make a case that the minute one of them did it, they both had already done it because they already recognized the validity of each other's orders. Those are two churches with very, very similar clerical cultures and very similar seminary cultures, so I don't think anybody would see much of a surprise there at all. The Episcopal Church, to some degree, nothing has really changed on what's functioning at the diocesan level. I mean, things have really not changed much for about a decade. Just a lot more things are being done out in the open that previously were done under what most people, Episcopalians, would call, quote, local option, unquote. The issue to me, anything that has to do with the Episcopal Church, right now, you and I have talked about this before. I've said it on your station a number of times. It's all about the Church of England. Right now, all you have to do is watch the Church of England and see if the current Archbishop of Canterbury is going to be able to run the clock out before he retires and hand this ticking bomb off to somebody else. It's all about the Church of England and what people there decide. Because until then, the Episcopal Church is the official body in America and will continue to win more than its share of the court cases, and millions of dollars will continue to go to lawyers to settle all the property disputes. I think it was in the mid-80s that I first wrote a column that said, at the moment, the Episcopal Church basically has no theology. All it has is property laws. And, you know, and we're about to prepare for decades of fighting over church properties. Because right now, nobody knows what the heck the Bible means, but they do know what deeds and trusts and pension funds. The laws on all that's pretty clear. And that's what they're going to be fighting over for three decades.
I was surprised that those didn't. That actually the court cases that, as you say, are just beginning now as people exit from the Episcopal Church USA. I'm surprised those didn't become part of the story there, because that is really the thing that's got legs here, is the court cases that will be for 30 years tying up the courts.
Well, you see, that's a case where I might be the wrong guy to talk to about that, because I'm in Washington, D.C., and the papers here, you know, in D.C. are all over this, because the mother of all property cases is the battle in the Northern Virginia suburbs, where you have several of the largest, richest, most historic churches in America that have chosen to leave. They're all here. So anytime anybody sneezes in those cases here, we get coverage. So at this point, maybe I'm the wrong guy to ask. Maybe the rest of the country isn't seeing coverage of that issue, but I'm seeing tons of it. In fact, if someone really is interested in that, all they would need to do is go to the Washington Times or the Washington Post and do searches for the names of some of those churches, like the Falls Church, Church of the Apostles, Truro, et cetera. And immediately, you know, you'd get lots of coverage. Just the papers here in Washington are all over that.
Well, when we come back, we're going to spend the last 10 minutes going through the rest of the top religion stories of 2009. At least according to the Religion News Writers Association poll, the next story I'd like to talk about is one that Terry mentioned at the top of our conversation, and that is the economy. Now, you say the economy isn't a religion story. Well, it is when you find major church and parachurch organizations laying off, 25% of their staff, when otherwise fairly financially insulated institutions like Pop American megachurches are asking for money, begging for money at the end of the year to make up a shortfall in their revenue. The economy affects everyone, and we're told that charitable giving is one of those things that is affected the most. When we come back, we'll talk about the national economy and how it is affecting not only those who are touched first, that is, the small church, the congregation, things like that, those mainline Protestant denominations that have lost a lot of members and therefore income over the last 30 years, and even some of the megachurches. Terry Mattingly is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday afternoon, the 4th of January. This is Issues Etc.
Think big screens belong in the movie theater, not at church? Think garage bands should stay in the garage, not be jamming in front of the altar? Hey, we do too. Come join us at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, for services that are reverent and relevant, vibrant and traditional. Divine service on Saturday at 6 p.m., on Sunday morning at 7:45 and 10, with Sunday school and Bible class in between at 9. Join us. Not a big screen or garage band in sight. Promise.
These days, value affords me a new attitude. It lets me appreciate that I can start my day with more than a $6 cup of coffee, and that I officially have permission to skip dinner out to spend time talking with my family over Casserole Inn. Concordia Publishing House offers Christian products that help me focus on what matters most. Visit any of the three Concordia bookstores downtown in Kirkwood and on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, or shop online at cph.org and find out what a new value attitude looks like in your life.
Often imitated, never equaled. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The new Issues Etc. YouTube video features Benny Hinn.
Adam was a super being, that he had dominion over the fowls of the air, the fish of the sea, which means he used to fly. Adam not only flew, he flew to space. With one thought, he'd be on the moon.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play.
Joel Osteen.
You may have to weed through 100 negative thoughts before you come to the right sound. The voice of victory that's saying, you are blessed, you are prosperous, you can do all things, your best days are still ahead. Latch on to those thoughts.
Never heard the word impossible this time, there's no...
And Deepak Chopra.
How come you're all so convinced that God is a he and Satan is a he? How come we have these ideas that are so mythical, that are so primitive?
Check out the new Issues Etc. YouTube video at issuesetc.org and click support.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Monday afternoon, January the 4th. We're going through the top religion stories of 2009, the year in review. Terry Mattingly is our guest, director of Washington Journalism Center. At the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, he writes the weekly On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service. He's founder of GetReligion.org, and he's author of the book Pop Goes Religion. Terry, one of the things that you mentioned, oh, and by the way, before we end our conversation, we're going to talk about the economy as it affects church bodies and parachurch organizations, and what I thought was the beginning story that I'm glad it made it on the list, although it was number 10, President Barack Obama's inauguration, where he had the likes of Reverend Rick Warren, Reverend Joseph Lowry, and New Hampshire Bishop Gene Robinson all helping him ring in his first term as U.S. president. We'll see what Terry thinks about that as a religion story coming up. We'll also get his thoughts on what he thinks might be some of the religion stories coming to the fore in 2010. Terry, you mentioned early in our conversation that the economy should be one of the top religion stories because of the way that it's affecting religious organizations. Why would you put that near the top?
Well, for two reasons. First of all, because the growing world, the world of churches that are still to some degree growing, and by that I mean the Assemblies of God, the Southern Baptist Convention, and some of the world of independent megachurch Protestantism, that world has even begun to be affected. I mean, when Rick Warren has to put out an appeal for emergency funds at Saddleback, the economy is beginning to hit everybody, right? So that's story number one. Story number two behind the scenes, though, is this: what about the churches that were already struggling? And that's the world of the Seven Sisters of Mainline Protestantism. You know, the Methodists, the Evangelical Lutherans, the Presbyterian Church, PCUSA, the Episcopal Church, the Disciples, the United Church of Christ, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What about those churches, the churches that already have lost, in some cases, one-third to one-half of their members over the last 20 to 30 years, and now have, you know, average age of people in the pews is beginning to top 55, 60, 62, 65, et cetera. These are churches that were already in tremendous financial problems. You throw in for them the state of the economy, and it begins to hit crisis mode. We're beginning to hit the stage where you're starting to see seminaries close. And some of these are seminaries that were already running on endowed funds, right? They weren't really alive. They were breathing air provided by previous generations of believers. So some of those seminaries now are even in trouble, even with the running on endowment. So you have two levels. How does the economy affect the basically healthy churches as they struggle a little? And how does the economy actually take the churches that were struggling down potentially to a whole other level, where something like the National Council of Churches begins to really have to think, at what point do we either not so much disband as at what point do we become a different organization?
That's what mystified me about the story we just talked about, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and the Episcopal Church, both taking further steps, arguably against the will of the average people in the pew, doing this, knowing it was going to put it crassly, affect their bottom line. And then both Catherine Jefferts Schori and Mark Hansen, the presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, with a straight face, inviting those who are disaffected by these decisions to stay in the conversation. And it sounds to me like, just please keep writing us your checks.
Well, I mean, this is the story of the last 25 to 30 years. There really isn't anything new there. The word dialogue has been defined and defined and defined and redefined over and over for so long. And in a world where property laws and pensions are just as important as creeds and hymn books, a lot of clergy are still sitting out there saying, in these hierarchical churches, am I willing to give up my pension? Am I willing to give up the building and the trust fund? Am I willing to launch out into, you know, suburban strip mall area and temporary facilities or a rented Seventh-day Advent church? Am I willing to do that? And that's the brass tacks that affected some dioceses and some regions as recently, you know, as far away as 20 years, this has already started happening. Now it's affecting more and more and more. We're watching the dissolution and the redefinition of the entire world of what used to be called mainline Protestantism.
Two quick final questions. One on the very last in the Religion News Writers Association poll. President Obama's inauguration writes that included unlikely bedfellows Rick Warren, Joseph Lowry, and Gene Robinson. What does this say about the president's view of the American religious landscape?
That in some way, as a liberal mainline Protestant, he believes that this dialogue ought to continue. I mean, Obama is the real deal. He is a sincere, articulate, practicing liberal mainline Protestant. He is what he is. I think in some ways the content of his religious views are easier to discern in terms of their intellectual tradition and where he's coming from, than George W. Bush ever was. I never really got a sense of what George W. Bush believed, other than the fact that he seemed to be a product of kind of the world of evangelical men's movements. But Obama, he is right up front with what he believes, and he is a sincere liberal Christian. And what you saw there was, I am willing to work with Rick Warren because he is willing to work with me on the following five or six issues. And he speaks for a lot of Americans. And to some degree, Obama might be saying, it is time that we need an evangelical left wing. And that's a story that I've been talking about at Get Religion from the first day we opened our doors. At some point, we are going to watch the development of a true evangelical left. And by this, I mean something far more important than, say, who's reading Jim Wallace books. I'm talking about seminaries. I'm talking about churches. I'm talking about people that are not just willing to say, I'm tired of being labeled the religious right. People who actually start changing the content of their moral theology. And Obama is saying, fantastic, let's go for it.
Finally, then, what do you think will be some of the top religion stories for 2010?
I don't have a clue. To some degree, everybody in this town is now about to switch back into the how many votes will the Democrats lose in the House mode, right? Kind of do the math, politics as usual, is where Washington is about to go. If I were going to look for political stories, I would continue to watch. The action is all in the Democrats. Continue to watch the Blue Dog Democrats of the South and continue to watch the consistently pro-life, in some cases liberal pro-life Democrats of the Midwest, and watch the Democratic Party try to wrestle with wanting to remain a majority party while still pleasing their strong secular and religious left wing of their party. At this point, the Republicans to me are pretty irrelevant. I'm spending all of my time watching the Democrats because the talent level on the Republican side right now is hilariously low. I don't know if there has ever been a major political party with a worse set of national leaders than the Republican Party at this point in its history. So you might as well watch the Democrats.
Terry Mattingly is director of Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the weekly column On Religion for the for Scripps Howard News Service. He's founder of GetReligion.org, author of the book Pop Goes Religion, and you can read Terry's columns and purchase his book, Pop Goes Religion, at our website, issuesetc.org. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to talk to you again.
Well, now I am intrigued when he suggests that there may be, in fact, emerging a genuine evangelical left. Well, we know it already exists. It's not like we're waiting for it to come around. We know that the liberal Christianity, that compromised form of Christianity, not only exists, it dominates mainline Christian church bodies. Can it emerge out onto the landscape, the political and social landscape, the same way that the religious right has? Many in the religious right say, well, it could never happen. Although, who knows? And if President Obama really does see this as part of the future of the American religious landscape and does things to try and bring it about, there may be an evangelical left wing to face, not only dominating mainline churches, but perhaps even the political and social landscape in the United States. Will it be the emergent movement? Will it be something that is looking post-Christian? I think probably it will consider itself a distinctly post-Christian movement, if only to distance itself from the religious right. But we'll wait and we'll see. A great resource for you to consider at the beginning of this new year, the Lutheran Study Bible. It's a great, I should say, good old-fashioned study Bible with the kind of sound scholarship you expect from the scholars who contributed to it. And also, you know where it comes from. It comes from a distinctly Lutheran, reformational standpoint. Grace, faith, scripture, and Christ alone, central in its study of the Bible, because that's how the Bible reads itself. Find out more about the Lutheran Study Bible at our website tonight, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and ask them about the Lutheran Study Bible. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's great to be back with you live on this Monday and for the remainder of this week and month. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.